Tonight's episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, they just brought a ton of previously retired designs back into stock, including Evil Dead, Creepshow, The Thing, Silence of the Lambs, and more. Also new, the officially licensed Bela Lugosi collection, which includes t-shirts, socks, and enamel pins. Also, they now have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre collection and a Chucky collection. So head to www.frightrags.com now, and you can enter the code SHOCK0118 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SHOCK0118. So head to frightrags.com now.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is Movie Buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They revamped their website earlier this year, and ordering has never been easier. Some of their latest and upcoming titles include the new Blu-ray of Spasms from Code Red, the amazing new Blu-ray DVD combo of Disconnected from Vinegar Syndrome, the Old Boy 5-disc box set, the all-region media book release of Zetter, and the Blu-ray release of Romero's Season of the Witch from Arrow. They also have all of the Agfa titles, Code Red, Scorpion release in Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, and more. The Shockwave team loves them, so head over to DiabolikDVD.com now. www.DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
The Shockwaves team is headed to Texas Frightmare this May, and we hope to see all of you there. Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention and is now celebrating their 13th year. They always have the best guests, the best panels, and you do not want to miss it. Just announced, Texas Frightmare will be showing a sneak preview of Arrow's upcoming restored Last House on the Left release, and they have cast members Jermaine Rain and Mark Scheffler there. Other guests include Clive Barker, several of the Cenobites including Doug Bradley, all of the kids from It's Losers Club, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith, Ron Perlman, Charles Band, Doug Bradley, Katie Featherstone, and many more. Head to www.TexasFrightmareWeekend.com and get your tickets now. Elric wants you to come and touch his face.
Yeah, I do.
No.
And we'll also give a little bit of love to Monster Fest Traveling Show. This is a horror film festival out of Sydney, Australia. It is going on from Friday, March 9th to Sunday, March 11th. They have some absolutely amazing films. Please check them out online. This is Monster Fest Traveling Sideshow.
You mad, you bastard.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 87 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm sitting here with Elric Kane.
What's going on?
Nothing much. I always go to you while you're drinking.
Yeah,
always.
You do.
Like, without fail, you always have something
in my head
going down the gullet.
Fidgety.
When I say your name. Also, Rebecca McKendry, now also picking up a drink.
I said that. I just happened to do that. So,
all right, I'm going
to
wait for Ryan to pick up his water before I introduce him.
You mean one of our friends?
One of his three bottles of water?
Three bottles of water in front of him.
I know to stay hydrated, guys.
Ryan Turek is with us also.
Hello.
A very hydrated Turek.
And that's a nice Michael Myers shirt, man.
This is some Creepy Company threads.
Wow.
That's nice.
Free plug. There you go.
Yeah.
I think it's nice.
Very cool.
So welcome back. Another week. What have we seen? Because I know there's some big titles that everyone wants to throw out. Mm-hmm.
Should we start with some little ones, or what do you want to do?
Let's go crazy.
Did everybody go see Annihilation?
I did not, guys, because I was in Texas. So I.
What were you doing in Texas, Becca?
I was hanging out with Fangoria. Yeah. So yeah, I instead of seeing Annihilation, which I hope to see this week,
Fangoria retreat filled with kind of I don't know, like office boosters, like, you know, like trust falls and stuff like that.
Not
like
as many trust retreat. Falls. No. There was no like high ropes courses or anything like that. No, it was a lot of talking about kind of what their vision is, where they're heading. Like they've got some really cool stuff planned for the magazine. It was really cool hanging with Phil and Meredith and everybody. And, you know, Preston is awesome and he's going to be working with them as well. He worked with us at Blumhouse.com as Natasha is over there now as well, who was also with us at Blumhouse.com.
Sweet.
And yeah, so we talked a lot about content, about, you know, we looked back through old issues and about what made Fangoria great.
Okay, what you're saying is you didn't see Annihilation.
That's all that matters.
This is a roundabout way of saying I didn't see
Annihilation. I did not see Annihilation.
You guys could have all gone to see Annihilation. Rob, did you see Annihilation?
I have not seen it yet, no.
All right.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey.
Hey, man.
We better talk about Annihilation.
Yeah, because I think if you don't talk about Annihilation, the fans are going to like completely
rally. We're also under a deadline because a big part of this is we want people to see this on a screen.
Yes.
And it might only be on the screen in
another couple weeks. I had very stern words from my father last night who was like, hey, by the way, I haven't seen Annihilation yet. And I was like, old man, you give me shit about the new Star Wars films and you get pissed off about a Han Solo like feature film, but you won't go see Annihilation on the big screen. He's like, I'll see it on Netflix. I'm like, you are part of the problem. Part of the problem, old man.
Unless he's in the UK, because it's getting a Netflix premiere.
It is.
Which
well,
is
it's
so
gonna
weird.
Be on, it's going to be on Netflix in the US. Like, it's just right around the corner.
It's definitely apparently. A scale movie. Yeah. That's what's cool about it. But like, let's start by before we even talk.
Well, did you love it?
I absolutely loved it too.
It's
I started
amazing.
With two people, Luke, who's been on the show before from Super Dark Times, and Dick. And it was late at night, and all of us were a little concerned. It was like 10 o'clock, and we're all old. And we're just, it's completely electrically because you're just so intellectually and aesthetically engaged.
So it's better than you are old.
It is a little bit better than I am old. But what's cool, just to preface this for everyone at home, is A, this is, you know, this is big, big idea sci-fi like Ex Machina, but it also contains, I'd say, two of the best horror scenes in a long time. Real horror scenes.
Pure terror. Ten minutes of terrifying terror.
And one part kind of is Event Horizon-y. There's all sorts of like little touches.
So I keep hearing Stalker mentioned.
Well, the best thing I heard before I saw it, and it actually makes me laugh after it ended, was somebody goes, it's Stalker for Dummies or Predator, like the most intellectual. Version of Predator you've ever seen. I'm like, that's kind of perfect. It's because it's not as like Stalker, and Rob just seen it recently, is pretty obtuse and abstract, but it's also like really engaging and but it's all about ideas. This takes those ideas and that kind of feeling, but also delivers like payoff in terms of like things happen, like big things, big sequences, big sci-fi ideas.
My favorite comment that I saw come out of the movie's reaction was, it's the best color out of space adaptation I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
I mean, I feel like that's spot on, but also, you know, kind of off the mark, but because this is also based on its own original book. But what I appreciate about the film, besides being highly engaging and very entertaining and coming to the table with a lot of giant ideas, is to just go pure weird at the end.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to give away anything, but it kind of lurched into about 15 minutes of playing into that Ryan that really loved Mother.
Yeah.
You know, and I think in any other system, in any other studio, the studio would have went, oh, we can't have this scene. Yeah. But it was just, it was very dreamlike and weird. And
open to interpret. I don't think there's a right interpretation. I think there's quite a, like, if five people see this ending, they're all going to maybe have slightly different interpretations. I'd love us to do a 10-minute when everyone's seen it on, like, what we think some of it means, because that would be something super interesting for people.
Listen, I mean, like, this is the most cosmic horror sci-fi movie you're going to see in a long time.
And yet it has a lot of the aesthetics of something like Under the Skin. And while I love Under the Skin maybe more for me, it's definitely less accessible. This is way more accessible.
Yes.
And more action-oriented. It's like an action film as well. Yeah. There's ideas and great
actors.
Yeah,
Under the Skin has a pacing thing.
It's a totally different kind of thing.
Isolates people.
Totally.
But what I love about it is it just feels so true, you know, that we're in a cold universe, in an uncaring universe, and there are a lot of forces beyond our control that alter things. Yep. It's funny, I was driving home from the movies the other night, and Ciara was going through looking at orchids or something like that, orchids that look like things. Mm. And she's like, oh my God, look at this flower. It looks like a monkey's face. And I was like, yo, that's Annihilation right there.
Yeah.
That's some weird Annihilation shit.
It's also beautiful, and not just like, oh, it's cinematic. No, there's moments of production design, and some of what could be horror is also the most beautiful thing you'll see in this movie. Oh, yeah. And when the Oscars happened, I think like the next day, the stage looked total annihilated, all these crystals. Yeah. I was like, that's pretty funny. But I think want to encourage people to see it on a screen, because this is a movie that, you know, was, I don't understand how film gets greenlit, and then at the end they go, oh, it's too weird, because on a script level, there's no way this wasn't totally weird a script level.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of, for $50 million, we're not going to get many of these in our lifetime.
No, Alex Garland slipped one through.
Yeah.
He slipped one through for The Good Guys, and he made a fantastic movie. And Natalie Portman is fantastic.
She's brilliant.
Movie.
And if you really like Ex Machina, this is easily as good. It's just a different kind of film. They're very different. That's self-contained
and
small.
I prefer Annihilation to Ex Machina, actually. It's just
I like them almost
taste.
Equally, but I think this one, I would rather see this one again. I don't know if I need to see Ex Machina twice.
I'm dying to see this again.
Oh,
dying
wow.
To
see. So two big thumbs up from half of the team for now.
And for now.
We'll add to it soon.
I will see it soon.
Rob?
Let's see. I watched, my one big pick of the week. I had taken advantage of a Kino Lorber sale a little while ago, and there's just so many films in Vincent Price and Christopher Lee's like filmography that I've never seen. And so I got one I'd never heard of called The House of the Long Shadows.
Ooh. Oh,
yeah, and this is from 1983. And I just woke up one morning. I was like, oh, I'll just put this on. This will probably be fun. And it was actually a very pleasant surprise. It's directed by Pete Walker. I believe it's the last film he ever did. And it's produced by Golden Globus. So I was like, oh, my God. And it's got Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, John Carradine. The lead star is actually Desi Arnaz Jr., the spawn of Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball. And the premise is kind of goofy. Basically, Desi Arnaz is like an American writer. And he bumps into this like Welsh guy, and they're getting in. Basically, he bets him that he can't write like a classic novel in 24 hours. And he, you know, I think they bet like something like $20,000, and he's like, I can do it for sure. And he's like, fine, well, you should go to my Welsh manor, which is supposedly haunted, and see if you could do it. And what's fun about this is he goes there, and of course, he bumps into some tourists on the way. At the bus station, because of course he gets lost on the way there. But then when he gets there, there's like caretakers, even though it's supposed to be kind of deserted. And then one by one, by mysterious circumstances, and this is what I love about it, is everyone gets a killer intro. Mm-hmm. Like, people just keep showing up. So, like, there's a mysterious guy at the door. There's a shadow. He comes in a frame. The score rises, and it's Peter Cushing. And you're like, there he is. Great. And then, like, 10 minutes later, same thing. But it's like, Christopher Lee, like, what are you doing here? And so they basically put them all in this scenario, and then weird shit starts happening around the house. Some of them might perish in the house, and now you're like, oh my God, what's going on here? But it was really goofy and fun, and not what I expected at all. I mean, it's very rare to see a movie with those guys that felt like an 80s horror movie.
Yeah, that's true.
This is one of the ones, like, oh, this feels like a traditional 80s horror movie. So. I really enjoyed it a lot, and it's got some. The ending might either win or lose you over, but I thought it was appropriate and very fun. So, House of the Long Shadows.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I'll start by saying I watched Murder on the Orient Express on a plane.
Which one? The new
Kenneth
Branagh.
The new one.
How is it?
I did not enjoy it, and I love murder
mysteries.
I love
the original.
Yeah, the original. This one, it's very much a spectacle film. The characters, they're very much caricatures, which I think it works in the original, because the original, I mean, Clouseau is
still
kind of a
great actors in that. I mean, obviously great actors in this, but they look like they're playing stars.
Yeah,
whereas the original, it's like Connery and people like that.
Yeah, it was not what I wanted it to be. I was really hoping for more. But that said, I continued on my plane venture, and I read Paper Girl. Which have you guys read yet?
No.
I think Rob has, because I thought Rob had recommended. Yeah,
I did.
Rob.
I recommended it to you.
So Paper
Girls. I think
Girls.
Derek Faraci had written, he wrote a lot of stuff for Blumhouse.com, usually recommending genre, stuff that genre fans would like in the comic book world. And he strongly recommended this graphic novel, and I picked it up and I loved it.
It's amazing.
And I figured it'd be up your alley
Completely.
Too.
Completely. Like, I'm seriously shocked that no one has optioned this to be turned into a TV show or movies or anything like that. It's about four 12-year-old girls who are paper girls in the 1980s. And so it opens with this, like, every, you know, it's always paper boys and how they kind of, you know, they're the first and what they had to do to get the job. And they're out delivering papers at 5 a.m. on Halloween morning in 1983, and some shit starts going down. It's like supernatural stuff, and it just goes from there. And the first one, I loved so much, just the characters and how different they are and all their different walks of life. It literally feels Stranger Things-ish, but different enough that it's kind of reinventing.
Who put this out again?
It's Image Comics. And it's by Brian Vaughn
created it, yeah.
And they're up to like book 4 or 5 on it now.
Oh, wow.
So it's definitely, it's gotten some popularity with it, but I absolutely loved it. As soon as I got off the plane, I was like sitting in the hotel that night. I ordered the next 3 editions.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've only read the first, and it's... it takes place on Halloween. I think that we should mention that.
All of the books or just that first book?
Just the first one. The first story that launches.
Because the whole thing, it happens that it's literally they're out delivering papers. It's 5 a.m. on Halloween morning because they're out doing their paper thing. And some crazy shit starts happening. And then you realize that there's aliens involved, but it's also, it gets pretty gory. There's monsters, there's opposing sides, and you don't know who's on what side or what they're supposed to be doing. But these are some freaking badass girls. It is riddled with 1980s references.
Yeah, I'm looking at a panel, and there's a kid dressed like Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, he jumps out because it's Halloween morning and they're trying to scare the girls, but these girls take shit from no one. They're definitely kind of like, one of them's an outcast and smokes and everything.
The art looks like Stray Bullets a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
Lapham style.
I'm gonna download this.
It looks cool.
It's so good. It was definitely like the highlight of my reading as of late. I also read another graphic novel called Rat Queens, which is not quite horror. It's more kind of medieval fantasy. But it was also awesome. So if anyone's into medieval fantasy, check it out. But horror, paper girls, all the way. So good.
Nice.
Cool. Did you hear about my Inside Number 9 deal?
No, what happened?
I don't know who runs their Twitter. Deal. Their Twitter account, who's been harassing me to watch Inside Number 9. And, and it turns out whoever runs it, has never seen Possession. I said, you watch Possession, and I'll watch Inside Number 9. It's now the person just bought it and posted that they just bought it, so I will deliver. I will start watching it, hopefully by next show.
I love that they are giving you shit. And
I know, it's like, who's stalking me here?
Because it has become so legendary that whoever runs the Inside Number 9
knows,
Twitter
listens to us
and, you know, pokes Elric, Reese, and Steve, the two guys who created the show, now tweet at me occasionally, like, have you ever gotten that co-host of yours to watch it? And so,
they'll start naming evil characters.
They follow me on Twitter now because of you.
All right, good.
Surprise, man.
All right, I'm going to commit to this shit because I'm sure I'm going to like it. You go, Ryan.
I got Stars recently, so I can kind of tune back into Ash vs. Evil Dead, which is interesting. But I discovered... On the Stars app, they have Bug, the 1975 film by Shino Zwark. And I have not, so fond memories of this film. My mom and I caught it on cable one late night, and it began, I think we both tuned in just as some cat was getting it by the bugs. And then I was like, all right, we're going to watch the rest of this. It's interesting looking back at it, looking at it now, because it's not at all what I remember it being. But if you guys don't know, this film is about a small, kind of dusty small town that experiences a massive earthquake, and it opens a gaping crack in the earth, and these kind of prehistoric bugs.
That's like Piranha 3D completely.
I know, prehistoric roaches come out of the earth, and they have the ability to set fire to things.
Like Firestarter roaches.
Yeah, Firestarter roaches.
Mecca, this should be up your alley.
I know, I've seen it before.
Oh, okay. You have? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this one has Bradford Dillman from Piranha, and he plays this professor who becomes obsessed with the bugs, and then what he ultimately winds up doing is merging like a common cockroach with one of these bugs, because these bugs, they come up out of the earth, but they can't stand our pressure, or they can't withstand the pressure of being topsoil. So they die after a period of time. He's like, no, I want you to survive. And then he crossbreeds these bugs, and he creates the ultimate firebug. And, you know, between point A and point B, what you get in the middle is, you know, these bugs kind of picking people off one by one. They crawl into your exhaust pipe. You're pretty much fucked if you're in the car, because they just, like, one little spark explodes, you know, but blows up the truck that you're in. They attack a cat, like I said. But the funny thing is when these bugs crawl on you, the way they depict it is that they'll kind of like crawl on your shoulder and they'll make these little clicking noises. And of course you don't notice. And then they'll just set fire to your hair, which means they set fire to your whole body. And then you set fire to your entire house and then you're fucked.
Which seems counterproductive because half the time when they're, I remember this, that they are on your body setting fire to you, but then you burn with the bugs on you.
Oh yeah, yeah. The bugs
don't give
a crap. So
the bugs are like, yeah, I'll totally take down your hair. I'll go with you, but fuck your hair.
But the funny thing is the way they depict the cat death is like they crawl up onto the cat and they set fire they don't set fire to the cat. Rather, they kind of like scorch the cat, so the cat gets scorched alive, but it doesn't erupt into full flame like humans. So this movie basically says humans are more combustible than cats.
So that's the takeaway.
That is my takeaway. It's funny. Flammable. I've always defended this film because William Castle produced it.
Yeah, and wrote it apparently.
Yeah, and I remember going back and just like looking at it on the store shelf and going, oh, I should watch that. And I was like, oh, I'm going to keep those fond memories of watching it with my mom alive. Yeah. And then I sat down and watched it. I was like, man, this movie has serious pacing issues.
And that's the director of Jaws, too.
Yeah, and that wouldn't have been the one that...
He
stepped up by doing Slasher Shark, you know? So.
What would he have done just before Jaws 2 to get him that gig? It wouldn't be that, right?
This is before
but there would be one more after this, right? Like, that probably wouldn't have gotten you that gig.
No, I think it was, actually.
Bug got him Jaws 2?
I can't believe it. It must be something after Bug.
When was Jaws 2 again? In 80, 81? Oh, 78.
Yeah.
So there's 4 years between, so there must be.
Wow.
There have to be something. Yeah.
Bug is the only movie. It looks like there's a TV movie called Codenamed Diamond Head, and he did a bunch of like Kojak and Beretta, like TV.
It's Beretta. Wow.
So how
he did Beretta. Beretta. And they're like,
just accept the fact that they went off Bug to get him the Jaws 2
game. This guy can make a scary movie.
Wow.
With Kruger's. Bug.
And even more terrifying, he made Supergirl and Santa Claus the movie.
Well, yes.
I remember
Santa Claus.
Santa Claus the movie.
Oh, wow.
There's only one, which is the Dudley Moore one.
I had the official magazine of Santa Claus the movie.
I think I had that too.
Right? Really?
Stoked. So he replaced, Juno Schwartz replaced the director of Let's Scare Jessica to Death, right? Because he started shooting like a week, maybe? He did like a week off.
Much longer than that, longer than that.
And then he got kicked off. That's just a bummer.
Yeah. Elric, top my bug.
Oh, I can top it. Actually, I can't. I was trying to jump in right after Rob because it relates to the one he watched, but a little Peter Cushing vehicle called that I had never seen, and I got excited when Grindhouse put it on. It came on TCM. Corruption, the one where he plays the so it was part of that release where Grindhouse got those three Sony titles, the Swimmer, kind of non-horror ones, the Swimmer and the Western film, I can't remember which was, and Corruption, the Peter Cushing one. And it's kind of like you were just talking about the 80s. It's kind of weird seeing, because I love Cushing. I'm definitely Cushing over Lee. Like, I love Lee, don't get me wrong, but Cushing is just like the guy I love from that period.
He could pop up in any movie.
Anything,
and
I like it.
He's so good.
He's just pimp. Like, every single time. It doesn't matter whether he's good or bad in the film. He's just smooth.
Look at those cheekbones. They're crazy cheekbones. I mean, crazy definition. But in this, it's like set in the swinging like late 60s or early 70s, and it's so weird seeing him in that time period. So he's a surgeon, and he's got this beautiful model girlfriend, and she at the start wants him to go to a party and in the kind of swinging London 60s, and he's kind of hesitant, and they get out, and then he gets into a fight with the guy photographing her because they're both kind of, he's a little jealous and he wants her not to be in that part of the world anymore, and they both knock over a light that he's photographed, and the light burns her face. And so then as a surgeon, he feels guilty. Then it tries to go Eyes Without a Face-ish, where the surgeon spends the rest of the movie trying to initially find a way to kind of solve the tissue problem and medically alter her face. And he thinks he's done it with some dead tissue from a dead body. But then, of course, after a couple of days, it fades and she's back to being disfigured. And so, of course, as you can, to make it a horror film, as it goes, he has to, you know, actually take a life, and he realizes that tissue is going to be better. But then he wants to keep doing it. And so what's interesting is she's an active participant, kind of goading. He's not a bad guy initially, but then he's pushed too far. There's a lot I like about it in terms of like how far they push him. It's very psychological. He put Cushing gives a great performance. Like, he's really, like, kind of by the end out of his mind, and kind of just, it's pretty damn.
This flyer is out of control.
Corruption is not a woman's
that is
picture.
Crazy.
Therefore, no woman will be admitted alone to see this super Corruption shock film.
I like super shock as a hyphenated word.
And what's interesting about that ad is I actually saw it without a woman. So that was interesting. I saw it alone, just me, and it went. It played fine. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe I listened.
Not a woman's picture.
It wasn't a woman's picture. So listen to them. But it's interesting. It doesn't. There's nothing about it that's particularly surprising, except maybe for Cushing, kind of the intensity of it. I don't think he. I can't think of ever seeing him in a performance quite like this. It's and some people will like that, and there's part of me that kind of doesn't, because he's like seeing your grandpa. Like, it doesn't go rapey. He had one film where he's kind of pushed in that direction. I remember that kind of hurt him. People said he didn't feel good about it. It's just not who he is towards the end of the Hammer thing. But, yeah, it's an interesting film. For me, I wouldn't blind buy this one. I saw it on TCM and enjoyed it. But those kind of surgeons trying to fix some error films are always kind of fun, but they also scream bullshit.
That is a very special, that is a specialized category for
Elric. I talked about scalpel.
We're
going to
be doing a Pure Cinema episode soon on scalpel.
Scalpel, yes. Problems with surgery.
Barnes & Noble won't know what to do with that film book.
Yeah, they don't know the one.
Medical or film and television?
And I might as well just so we can go to the next person. Tigers Are Not Afraid. I caught up on it.
Did you love it?
I thought it was a really great little film. Yeah. I liked, you know, it feels like it's like an art, foreign art film that happens to have some horror moments. Mm-hmm. The horror moments are really effective. They remind me a little bit of Don't Go in the House.
Yep.
The actual things that I'm talking about. But it also reminds me a bit like City of God, which is, you know, great foreign film that won Oscars and stuff years ago. It, you know, the world of the kids is really well realized. Mm-hmm. And it's got that almost magical realism that they're in their own world, and then it gets punctured by these kind of the gang members in Mexico. And I think it is a really good little movie. I kind of almost might see it again on a screen. You know what I mean? Like, I know it's going to be playing at the festival we're going at Chattanooga. Just to get that full immersion experience. But I think people will dig it. It's small, but in a way that's really well realized.
I have a feeling it's going to make my top 10 this year.
Yeah, no, I could totally see that. And the horror moments are horror in a way that's good. It feels like, because it's part of their bubble. You don't know if it's real.
Yeah.
A lot of the film, you don't know what's real and what isn't, but it's part of the kids' perception of things. Because the movie opens with a girl being told she'll have three wishes, even
she's
though
magical.
It's just her teacher trying to, you know, make her feel better in a time where the schools might be being shot up or something. And I think this, you can't really say too much about it because there's only a few nice, like, little surprises, but I liked it a lot.
I bawled my eyes out.
Yeah, no, like, I can see that. Yeah. I could see you bawling your eyes
out. Yeah, you totally can. Well, I checked out, I'd seen this film before, but it was awesome to see it in this form. The new fancy Blu-ray edition of Liquid Sky from Vinegar Syndrome.
It's sitting on my shelf, and I've never seen it.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm excited to see it for a
visit. I'm anxious to see what you think about it, because it is such a weird mix of all these different types of films, to the point that it just kind of is none of them. It's about a model in New York City, this very kind of androgynous model, who is in this incredibly high-pressure, very competitive art world where she literally plays her own rival. She plays her male rival that she supposedly hates, and they're always competing for the same jobs, which is really weird to begin with that she plays two roles in the same movie. But what she discovers is she keeps getting attacked and raped in various capacities. And every single time it happens, the person dies. These aliens appear out of nowhere and kill this person. And so it happens a couple of times, and she begins to realize that the aliens are trying to suck this particular hormone that is released at the moment of orgasm. So they're literally following her around, killing anybody that she has sex with. And I don't even know what to make of the plot. Like, there is so
much
going on.
Tell me no more about the plot, because that's the best plot I've ever heard.
But the plot is so secondary, because the majority of what you see is this weird art world. So where for 10 minutes you're watching this spoken word performed by the girl from Alice Sweet Alice. This, like, crazy spoken word performance. And then you're at this weird modeling shoot. And then at the same time, it tries to be a comedy at points. Oh. And so there's, like, weird
comedic moments. That I'm less excited
about.
That doesn't
it's
sound right.
It's crazy. But the whole movie, it's very hypnotic. It's very hallucinogenic. It's obviously got these weird aliens with it as well. And so I had seen this originally on VHS, and then I've had a bootleg copy of it for years, but it's always been really shitty and grainy. So it was really nice to finally watch it restored. It's got a weird soundtrack too. The guy who made it, Slava...
Yeah, Sukerman,
something like that. They actually did a screening of it at the hotel. It's a hotel now at the shitty building in New York where they shot it, which was a shitty building at the time when they shot it. It's now like a really nice hotel a couple of years ago that I really wanted to go to. But yeah, it's just a batshit crazy film. So I'm glad that it finally got a nice release.
I'll try to watch it for next week, but I got a fun film nerd story for you that you'll appreciate, because I actually talked about. So I know the cinematographer of that, Yuri, And one of his students is a student of mine, and he was telling me a great story about that because he has the original camera that Meshes of the Afternoon was shot by Maya Deren. And I asked how he got it, and it's because of this movie. He was shooting this movie, and he needs a different kind of Super 8 camera. It has a giant body that she shot that on, and he needed a camera. He asked Andy Warhol. So this is in New York. Andy Warhol goes, oh, I know someone, and asks Maya Deren, and they go, yeah, you can use our camera. And they gave it to him, and he shot a lot of the, I don't know if there's experimental sequences shot
there's
on Super 8.
Tons
he shot that on that
sequences.
Camera. And then kept this camera and has the camera that film was. And I was like, that's an amazing story.
Oh my gosh.
If you're into Maya Deren.
Yeah, that's totally.
So I got to see it. I've been meaning to see it for a long time. So.
Yeah, so that just came out. I think it came out this week, if not next week, from Vinegar Syndrome, the Blu-ray of Liquid Sky.
Oh, that came out. No, it came out a bit ago, right? Because it was part of that sale with Ice Cream Man and stuff, and they all sold out.
Yeah, it was a Black Friday release.
Okay, maybe my copy just arrived.
They might have sold out for a while, too.
Let's see what else. I watched Veronica, which we talked about last week on Netflix. A lot of people seem to have caught up with it.
What'd you think?
I was really impressed. I think you had said it's like, it's really solid, but not like, the problem with it, and this isn't with it, it's just kind of with the advertising, is there's so many articles floating around that's like, this is scarier than The Conjuring or whatever. Like, this is the scariest thing you'll find on Netflix. It's not that, but it's really good.
Yeah.
And in fact, like, I clicked on one of those articles to see what it said, and the opening paragraph is like, this movie is so scary that you will shut your laptop down. And I'm like, all right, if you're watching your Netflix on a laptop,
cinema, please.
Then fuck you.
That's how you fucking write a headline.
I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll never read this site again. But no, I thought it was really solid. And it's Paco Plaza. I mean, obviously, he's one of the Rec directors. But it had that kind of it's set in the 90s. And it reminded me a little bit of Rec. But it plays upon some of the, like, to me, like, it felt like it was picking up. It's not about sleep paralysis, but the sort of thing because I've suffered from it, that sort of thing is kind of, it kind of hit that on the head and had a little bit of an Exorcist thing going too. And so I really liked it. I think anything he does kind of interests me. And one thing that he did that nobody really talks about is he did a Christmas horror movie called The Christmas Tale.
Mm-hmm.
It came in that. I guess
eight
it's like
films to
films to keep you awake. Yeah.
And that was his?
Yeah, yeah.
That's really good.
With like
a
female
films,
like
yeah.
Killer Santa sort of and a bunch of kids set in the 80s. He's got that style where he can capture these different time periods, the 80s, 90s and really evoke like American cinema and stuff. So, yeah, if you haven't seen Veronica, I think it's a really solid movie. Just don't expect it to be the greatest movie of all
time.
Did
you see this?
I have not seen Veronica yet.
She is right now. I think it's going to be Shockwaves approved.
Yeah. Guys, the only thing that keeps some of these titles held back from being Shockwaves approved is the slow.
Dallas. It's Dallas.
Excuse me. I read a lot. The next thing, books, guys, books.
Go join Bria's podcast.
Oh. On a plane, you tools.
That's funny. And the other thing is I've been on a big Hitchcock kick lately.
I noticed that on your letterbox one day where it popped up and it was like, Rob G's been watching and it was all this old Hitchcock stuff.
Yeah, I mean, because I have like the Masterpiece Collection, which is like the last 15 films, but he made so many movies that I don't, and I try to go see them on the big screen when they play if I can, but like, Criterion had a sale, and I bought there. They put out a lot of the late 30s, 40s one in a box called Classic Hitchcock. And so I talked quite a bit about it on my other show, but the one that I want to mention here that I think will be interesting to horror fans is Spellbound, which is the one he did in 1945. And the basic premise is that Ingrid Bergman, who did a couple of movies with him and is gorgeous in this film, like classic Hollywood, like. Yeah. You see some of these people and you meet like, God, no wonder they were a Hollywood star, you know?
I feel like Britt Marling has that same thing as Ingrid Bergman, but she hasn't been in big enough things yet, but she's got that quality, you know?
Yeah.
It's a hard... Yeah,
it's rare that anybody has that these days. But she's a psychiatrist helping an amnesia patient who is accused of murder, and that is played by Gregory Peck, who is ridiculously young. I've never seen him this young before in anything. And the reason I bring it up is for two reasons. One... It really was, to me, very similar to Psycho. And someone had mentioned to me, I think, on Twitter, like, oh, yeah, it actually played on a double bill with Psycho not too long ago. And I was like, that totally makes sense because Gregory Peck is doing a total Perkins thing. And, I mean, this is 15 years before that, but he's got that Perkins thing where you're not sure he's this good-looking, charming guy, but is there something sinister underneath? So there's that and the fact that he's the one and only time Hitchcock worked with Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And
basically, Dali had, there's
the dream sequences are
a dream sequence in here, and it was all
there's
designed.
A couple, right? Yeah. And there was about 30 minutes cut of it.
Like, yeah, because that's the thing. There's not much, but there is at least one, and it was pretty mind-blowing to see Hitchcock directing Salvador Dali. Because you go in and it immediately looks like one of his paintings where somebody's cutting like an eye out, and you know, you're like, holy shit.
I would have killed to be a fly on the wall in those like early production meetings.
You know what it looks like? It actually looks like Slender Man. It's a thing with a mask and a suit and like weird scissors, and there's lots of really interesting imagery. But the it's one of those big missing things in film history where there would have been like 35 minutes more of this, and instead we get like 10 minutes because it's quite a talky
movie. I don't know if they shot it all. That's the thing.
I think they did shoot. I think it was lost footage. Like I think they just because Hitchcock decided not to use it. I think.
Yeah.
But people who's I'm pretty sure we'll look into that. But yeah, it's cool. Those sequences are something special because it's unlike anything else Hitchcock ever really did.
Yeah, and that's why I was kind of taken aback by it. So if you're a horror fan and you want to see a Dali painting come to life and Gregory Peck channel kind of Anthony Perkins Psycho, Spellbound is kind of a pretty solid flick.
Yeah, the only bad thing about that movie is that because it's kind of early when Americans are getting excited about psychoanalysis, there's lots of talking about psychoanalysis, and that part's kind of, I find it to be one of the more kind of boring, there's boring dialogue sequences.
You know what's funny? Because I've literally been watching a ton of them in a row, and you know, these are spanning from the 30s to the 40s, 50s, and all that. You know, some old movies from that era, the, you know, classic Hollywood movies, sometimes like, you know, the pacing's a little off, or you know, it takes a while for things to get going. I find with all these Hitchcock movies, they're so sharply written and really smart and witty and and fast-paced and kind of like I have no – like they don't – they feel timeless. They really do. And so even though you're saying that, I just watched it and I didn't sense that at all.
It's kind of like it's kind of like the end of Psycho.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. Like, I don't need the end of Psycho because you're talking about the problem. Because Hitchcock's, like, at his best when he's showing you stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the best filmmaker to ever live, in my opinion, when he's just showing you a story. And I think he could have just shown stories, but he also knew to get everyone excited.
To get the audience.
Yeah, you get everyone involved.
Yeah.
It's an interesting movie.
No, it's solid. Anything else, anybody?
I'll talk really quick about one of the other books that I read while I was on the plane. I am pushing my way through Junji Ito's Tomie, and you guys have heard me talk a lot about Ito in past. I'm just like a huge fan of his work. I have never read Tomie. I saw the movie, the original movie, probably 10 years ago,
when it first came out.
So I saw it a really long time ago. I had not read any of the comics. I love the mythos. I still don't know how I feel about it. And I'm only about I brought my Tomie tome in.
Book,
it's literally like all of the Tomie.
The art's cool. Like it looks really badass.
The whole mythos of her is she's clearly like a succubus where she can kind of be born out of nothing. She makes men and women at some points fall completely madly in love with her to the point that they start killing each other. And then they're forced to kill her. She's got cannibalistic tendencies, and then she can be reborn, she can morph, she can kind of like shrink down and go into cracks in the wall and things like that. So she's like completely amorphous, and she can kind of appear out of space and time. And at times, other people in the story will become Tomie. So what I'm saying is there's no fucking rules to this whatsoever. To the point that – and it feels like at times like it's reinventing itself as it goes on, much like Tomie.
Will all the people who cried about It Follows not following the rules have a problem with this?
Oh, my God, yes. So,
calling you out, Matthew Curry, huh?
That's been kind of one like just when you think like – I finished – probably I'm like a third of the way through this. And just when I'm like, okay, I have the rules of Tomie down, it's like it completely reinvents itself. There is some type – and I mean, granted, this first one was written – these were written over decades. The first one was written in 1987. And then Ito added to them as they grew in popularity. There's some type of weird social messaging in here. I have no idea what it is yet. I'm still trying to figure it out. Because there's obviously – it's got some like weird messaging about females being succubuses and being evil. And then they always kill them. And then it's great. But she just keeps popping up. And so, yeah. But at the same time, I am so mesmerized by it. I love Junji Ito. Like, seriously, he can do no wrong in my eyes. It has his same kind of goo-filled, amorphous, just surrealist world that I love.
Goo-filled.
It is. Like, the book is goo-filled.
His goo-filled tome.
I have not...
It kind of is slimy.
I know, right?
Even
the cover
finger.
Feels like it. But even... I have not seen the movie version that they did, the Japanese movie, in a really long time, so I just ordered it, so I'm anxious to watch it and kind of get the adaptation. But they did a whole bunch of Tomie films. And there was apparently an anthology TV show.
I think they were trying to... Somebody was
trying to remake it at one time too.
I'm like, interested to see that? What could be done with it, because it doesn't necessarily, it's not like it has a beginning, middle, and end. It kind of has, and she has an MO, but there's not so much of a beginning, middle, and end to it. It just continues. So,
what else did you read, Becca?
Well, that's go fuck yourself, King. So yeah, that's it for me this week.
He got me.
I'm going to throw out two more, one that kind of ties into our guest. But I saw Godzilla Planet of the Monsters, the feature-length anime that's on Netflix right now. I thought it was a series. I thought it was like 30 minutes long, 30 minutes apiece. And then 30 minutes in, I was like, wait a minute, this is still going. And then I realized the runtime. But it's part one. The gist of this movie is... Godzilla is such an asshole and monsters have run rampant all over the earth that basically humanity has to just get out of Dodge and leave Earth. And in a kind of very Battlestar Galactica-esque way, all the rest of the human race is on this, on a series, I think it's on one ship, or was on a series of ships, but now it's down to one and the last of the human races are on the ship and they're trying to figure out how to either find a new Earth or they got to go back home.
And it's animated.
And it's animated. And so, you know, obviously there's some time-space shit that's going on. So they think they've only been away from Earth for however many years, but really time on Earth has passed for like 20,000. And they're like, oh, great. We should be able to get back. Godzilla's dead. Nothing could have survived that long. So they put together this giant plan, and Godzilla is still around. He's hanging out, roaming Earth all by himself, presumably. And then they get down to the planet, and there are all these crazy, like almost dinosaur-like monsters, and there is Godzilla. And they discover that within Godzilla, there's this kind of he's got this kind of shield that he raises anytime he comes under attack. So they have to try to figure out the biology of this internal shield. That way they can bring him down. So it's kind of cool, but there is nothing but tech talk for like an hour of this movie where they're just talking about spaceships and levels and mechanics and biology and all
this
stuff.
Is this for kids or adults?
I mean, it's a little mix of both. I watched it with the kiddo and she seemed into it. We also tried to watch Devilman, which was an uncomfortable experience that I had to shut down. She was like, let's watch Devilman. I'm like, okay.
I don't even know what Devilman is.
Oh, Devilman's an old school anime that they gussied up for Netflix. Not for kids. Not for kids at all. Nice. Full blown orgies popping in about 10 minutes in.
Goodness.
And I was like, wow. But anyways, back to Godzilla. The cool thing about it is Godzilla is just, I mean, this isn't your friendly Godzilla. Right. He will wreck you. He just stomps around. His fire breath is like lightning fast. What's kind of cool about it is they bring like super futuristic sci-fi technology up against Godzilla, and they've got these flying motorcycle things that fly around. It was kind of cool, but you just got to kind of wade through all of this, this tech miasma and sci-fi nonsense. There's like no human drama to it whatsoever. But then again, when was there any like after the first Godzilla? I want to say that it services the monster, but much like the Gareth Edwards film, there's very little Godzilla until the very end. So you're just kind of like, come on, guys. Can someone just deliver on a wall-to-wall Godzilla movie?
Yeah.
Can it just have monsters beating the shit out of
Michael
each other?
Michael Dougherty's our savior here.
I really hope so.
With his Godzilla movie.
My daughter, I can say this on air because she doesn't listen to the show, but her birthday's next week, and we got her this giant Mothra. Uh-huh. Because she loves Mothra so much, and
she also loves Devils, man.
Weird Kane. Jesus
Mothra.
Christ.
There's been a Mothra in a while, since 90s, so yeah, we need another.
And then I'll wrap up. I watched Strangers. I saw The Strangers.
Oh, yeah.
Brad Knight.
Isn't that tie in to certain elements of our show coming up?
It does.
Yes,
it does.
Yes. Wow.
I actually didn't realize that until on my way here because I was like, oh, I know we got the 47 meetings. I was like, oh, he's doing the news. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. It all works out.
And he does his homework.
And I feel comfortable talking
today while I drive.
I feel comfortable talking about it because he's also on the show. But I think Johannes did a really good job with it. I think it's pretty fun.
Can you clarify
fun?
If it's
because the first one's not fun?
Yeah.
No. What he did is he extracted the fun from the premise and made an audience pleasing strangers.
Mm. So it's not quite as beating you down. I will never watch this a second time.
No, it isn't this dead end. Somber reflection on random violence in the home.
Well, that's what I liked.
No, yes, that's the thing. There's some people are going to like that. Some.
Well, I watched it. I watched The Strangers.
Back to back?
Yeah, I watched the Scream Factory Blu-ray, which they did a fantastic job on. I rewatched it. Ciara watched it for the first time. And at the end, she was like, I don't like The Strangers. And I was like, what do you mean? It's really terrifying. And I was like, you were just sitting here jumping the entire way. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, but that's not the kind of horror I like. It's not fun. Last night, she was jumping out of the seat, going, shoot that motherfucker. And, you know, like that is the kind of audience-pleasing, rousing slasher movie that Johannes made.
Yeah.
So
is it because I had asked somebody recently, and they said, oh, it's kind of like a reboot. And then I asked somebody else if they'd said it was a sequel. And I was like, wait, where does it fall?
It's both. It's both. Huh. It's kind of like a
reboot. Do the events happen from the first one?
Or you don't does know. It matter?
Okay. It doesn't really matter. You just kind of go in, and you're introduced to a new family, and the strangers come out. There is a you'll see it in the trailer. There's a fantastic sequence in a swimming pool. That's surrounded by these kind of neon palm trees, and it's set to music, and it's really, really well
You'll done. See it in the trailer. I'm not going to watch the trailer. I'm going to watch the movie. in fact, before Annihilation, the start of the Hereditary trailer came, and of course the people I'm there
what
with
do you
have
do?
Seen it, and I just went, and I put my head in my lap and just closed my eyes, and listening to it, because I listened to the Witch trailer back in the day the same way, it's like way scarier. I have no idea what's going on, but I know it's bad.
I
know.
Want to be at a theater with Kane where he covers his eyes like a little
I got really,
boy.
I got scared because I was like, I just do not want to see anything. I want to watch it.
Walk out for 20 minutes. No, you sit there, and then every audience member is like, "Who's this?
What
with
the fuck
that
is
guy?
Wrong with that guy?"
I haven't done that
He's
since White Girls.
Scared of the trailer.
He's allergic to trailers. But no, listen. It satisfied the slasher fan in me. I had a really good time with it. Johannes does a lot of Carpenter-esque camera trickery and placement. Expect a lot of slow zoom-ins.
Yeah.
The title font is very Dead Zone-esque, Stephen King-esque. All of the influences are being worn on his sleeve, and we'll talk about it later in the show.
That's very cool.
And that's
very
theatrical, cool. Right? We can see this.
Yeah, it comes out this week. When this episode is.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I will see it.
It's out today.
Two quick things to mention before we head into the interview portion. Number one, as I've mentioned it before, but I haven't had a chance to really talk about it in the last 3 weeks out of sheer exhaustion. But obviously, I'm heading up this Dread Central Presents label. And so I want people to know these movies are available now. Becca talked about The Lodgers last week.
It's great.
Brian O'Malley's movie, and that is on VOD now, so you can rent it on Amazon.
Saw it on Amazon.
The one nobody knows about this one, and it's close to my heart, but there's this Chinese movie called Zombieology, Enjoy Yourself Tonight, and that is also out on VOD now, but I think it's a little harder to get the word out about those kind of movies. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's a lot of fun, has a lot of heart. I know I'm tired of zombie movies myself, but this is kind of different. And this is out there for rent. You can just find it on Amazon. There's one review, which I wrote, of course. So that's how I know you. That's how I know you haven't seen it yet. So just check out what we're doing with Dread Presents.
There was something else you posted in the group. There was something else you got that I was like, oh, I've seen that. And I'm trying to figure out what it is.
Well, let's see. So we released Zombieology and The Lodgers are both on VOD now. Vilmark Asylum is on Amazon Prime as a Prime exclusive. And we're putting out Terrifier, which is a killer clown movie, the next week.
Yep.
Hashtag Screamers, Imitation Girl.
Screamers.
Screamers.
Hashtag Screamers.
Yeah. Tom Malloy, who was in... The Alphabet Killer. It's a movie that he did. That one comes out in April. So we got quite a lot coming out, and we just announced Anthony DeBlasi's new movie, Extremity.
Oh, yeah. That's,
and
yes.
He did Last Shift and Clive Barker's Dread. A lot of cool movies. So there's a whole crap ton of stuff coming out, and just support it, please. Check it out. And lastly, I don't know, congrats to the Blumhouse team. Obviously, the Oscars
Oscar
happened.
Oscar gold, yeah. Man.
And it seems, you know, Del Toro and Jordan Peele doing us good.
Except what made horror fans unhappy that night?
Oh, an exclusion of Toby Hooper.
Which is particularly painful when Spielberg's in the audience and you know they're all buddies. And it's just like, come on, man. Like, can't we just get the shit right? You got Romero. You forgot Hooper. And then before
they showed footage. Yeah.
I was so excited when I saw the clip of Chainsaw. I was like, oh, cool. There's going to be a big tribute coming up. And then I was like...
They always just find a way to fuck it up.
But they have fucking script supervisors who died. It's like, this script supervisor died. Oh. And you're like, what? You forgot Toby?
But not
no offense to that script supervisor and their family.
No. Who are obviously listeners, but still.
they got their due on the Oscars. They're not getting it here. But it was really cool. I loved seeing, that was the pick in my Oscar pool. I knew he was going to win Best Screenplay.
I felt really strong about that.
And I didn't really want, and the reason I wouldn't want someone like him to win Best Director is because I think he's going to do it again. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is a start for him. So I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
Congrats.
I was going to say, next week, when we come back, I'll be fresh from South by Southwest.
So we've got
two titles there. We've got Upgrade, and then we have an untitled film that we did with writer-director Steven Susco and our friends Timur Bekmambetov and Baz Lives.
Nightwatch Timur?
Huh?
Or is that T-Bone?
Yeah.
Nightwatch Timur. I love that.
Well, he didn't direct it. He didn't write it. He produced it with us. He also co-produced Unfriended with Blumhouse.
I still haven't seen it. I haven't seen it.
It's good. I'm telling you, it's good.
But there's a lot of good stuff playing at South By. Owen Edgerton's Bloodfest. I don't know if you saw the trailer for that, but it looks like a fun, bloody romp.
I heard the trailer.
Hereditary? Yeah, I know. Somebody's like, hey, Elric, watch this. No, listen to this.
Hey, Elric, can you listen to my new short film? I get those requests.
Hereditary is going to be playing there. Quiet Place is going to be playing there. So, yeah, I'll come back with some fresh cuts.
Well, speaking of awesome film fests, we should go ahead and start plugging because it's in a couple of weeks. Hey, we're all going to be at the Chattanooga Film Festival.
Is that in a couple
Festival.
Weeks?
Holy balls, there's some amazing looking movies at that thing too.
Yeah, like, Chattanooga I'm really excited. Film Festival, we will be there, but a lot of really good movies will as well, like The Endless and
The
Ranger.
Revenge, that film Revenge, I'm dying to see that film.
All the Creatures Were Stirring looks okay.
Becca's movie, that's right.
So,
and lastly, if you're sitting at home feeling guilty listening to the show because you've never done anything for us, this is the opportunity you've been waiting for because we have yet to plug the Rondos.
Yeah.
And I think we should.
Yeah.
Because, you know, why not? Because
we're nominated
against 27 or 35 other shows.
At least 40.
At least. But if you feel like.
Not all shows, some are websites.
Whatever they are.
Some are trailers.
Best Multimedia, I don't know which number it is. Go to Taraco's house and ask him to put a Rondo sticker on his head.
If you just go to the Rondos, rondoawards.com, there's instructions on how to enter there. It's a little old school. You have to email your ballot in, but we are nominated under Best Multimedia Website.
Yes, and if you think we've won too many of these, Shockwaves have never
we've
won.
We've never won.
It was under Killer Preview, and it would be nice to win this.
Yeah, we'd love to have a Shockwaves win. Yeah. So
it's 18 on the ballot.
Number 18.
18, thank you.
Could be cool.
But instead of just being a jerk and just going on there and voting for us, honestly, there's some really cool other horror things on there.
Oh, yeah.
Take the time, look through the ballot. There's some great articles, magazines, really cool stuff. Vote for something good, so good things.
Well, while you're voting, because it's, you know, unfortunately, they list us as Blumhouse's Shockwaves podcast, the Unholy Trio. They leave Ryan out again. No respect for Ryan Turk.
No respect.
So let's not only win it for Best Multimedia, but every year I recommend Ryan for Monster
Don't
Kid.
Don't worry about that.
This would be a good year for you of the Monster Kid, because what other kid can say they got Halloween reboot?
That's right.
Reboot.
That's right.
Yeah. And then we can be the Unholy Quadrilogy.
Yeah. That'd be
nice. It's got a total ring to it.
Unholy Square.
Unholy Square.
The four corners.
So that was a lot of asks. So vote, do all those things for us, and we will thank you.
Yay! Thanks, guys. We'll be back in a sec.
We'll get our guest. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, they just brought a ton of previously retired designs back into stock, including Evil Dead, Creepshow, The Thing, Silence of the Lambs, and more. Also new, the officially licensed Bela Lugosi collection, which includes t-shirts, socks, and enamel pins. Also, they now have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre collection and a Chucky collection. So head to www.frightrags.com now, and you can enter the code SHOCK0118
at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's Shock0118. So head to FrightRags.com now.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is Movie Buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They revamped their website earlier this year, and ordering has never been easier. Some of their latest and upcoming titles include the new Blu-ray of Spasms from Code Red, the amazing new Blu-ray DVD combo of Disconnected from Vinegar Syndrome, the Old Boy 5-disc box set, the all-region media book release of Zutter, and the Blu-ray release of Romero's Season of the Witch from Arrow. They also have all of the AGFA titles, Code Red, Scorpion release in Arrow Video, Vinegar Syndrome, and more. The Shockwave team loves them, so head over to DiabolikDVD.com now. www.DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
The Shockwaves team is headed to Texas Frightmare this May, and we hope to see all of you there. Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention and is now celebrating their 13th year. They always have the best guests, the best panels, and you do not want to miss it. Just announced, Texas Frightmare will be showing a sneak preview of Arrow's upcoming restored Last House on the Left release, and they have cast members Jermaine Rain and Mark Scheffler there. Other guests include Clive Barker, several of the Cenobites including Doug Bradley, all of the kids from It's Losers Club, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith, Ron Perlman, Charles Band, Doug Bradley, Katie Featherstone, and many more. Head to www.TexasFrightmareWeekend.com and get your tickets now. Elric wants you to come and touch his face.
Yeah, I do.
No.
And we'll also give a little bit of love to Monster Fest Traveling Show. This is a horror film festival out of Sydney, Australia. It is going on from Friday, March 9th to Sunday, March 11th. They have some absolutely amazing films. Please check them out online. This is Monster Fest Traveling Sideshow.
You mad, you bastard.
All right, we have a guest in the house who has a film opening today in theaters called The Strangers Pray at Night. I'd like to welcome Johannes Roberts.
Hello.
How's it going, sir?
Yeah, very good, very good.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
He also had a film that made Becca's top 10 last year.
and scared the shit out of me.
Sharks in the House.
47 yeah. meters down, also behind the other side of the door. Yeah. Which
we all kind of universally enjoy.
Yeah.
That's three people.
Yeah.
Well, it's weird because we never agree on much of anything. Yeah. So for us to kind of just be able to go, yeah, guys, that was like we all agree that was fun. So
I loved that movie, and the experience on that was great fun. And I just thought I'd made that was the movie I got into this job to do. You know, I made Pet Sematary in India. You know, that was great.
We even got I'm glad you admitted that.
We even showed it to King. Because I wanted to sorry, that's my phone just
charging in the corner.
Your phone is charged, sir.
I wanted to get the rights to Hearts in Atlantis, and he said, well, I need to watch your new film. So I said, well, look here, watch Other Side of the Door. And so he did. I said, would you give me a quote, you know, for it? And he just responded, you know, I think I'd be a little uncomfortable. Because he must have sat there watching it going, I wrote this, didn't I? that was a tough one because some of the reviews were pretty brutal when that first came out. I think it was just the wrong time. I don't know. Anyhow, but I loved the movie a lot.
Well,
but,
I think they were unfair to it because I think it had a lot of heart and soul to
it. It did.
Some really creepy shit.
Yeah.
Really creepy.
Oh, yeah, the actual thing, the actual creature. It was super creepy. It was a great, pleasant surprise to go in with not knowing much lower expectations than being, I'd much rather that. Yeah.
Was
film,
the mythos already existing or did you kind of create it from scratch?
No, I'm a big, the one thing that draws me constantly in horror is doors, oddly, and knocking on doors. You know, I love The Fog, but that kind of thing, hence Strangers. And
You'll love Knock Knock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Two knocks in the whole film.
Exactly.
Your perfect movie.
Yeah. And so I just had this idea of like, whatever you do, don't open the door. I love it when you're given a rule. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite thing. I love it. And it always drives me nuts when people go, oh, God, you opened the door. What the fuck? What do you want from this, man? That's a horror movie. You wanted to not open the
there's
door.
There's no plot, literally. She is appeared and there's nothing left.
Well, the challenge, if you're going to lay down a rule, the challenge as a creator, as a storyteller, is to give them a good reason to break
to
that
do it.
Rule.
Yeah.
Make it feel true.
Yeah.
And I felt like that, I think that felt very true.
Yeah.
But let's dive into a little strangers, a spoiler free conversation, and then we'll kind of work backwards back into your shark,
my shark,
shark exploitation.
Sharks.
You know, strangers. You know, the sequel is coming 10 years after the release of Brian De Bertino's film. This is obviously one that's been kicked around for quite a while through, you know, nothing more than just business stuff going on. How did it come across? How did it come across your desk, and when did it actually fire up for real? I mean,
candidly, I had just sort of finished 47, and actually, nobody really wanted to speak to me. You know, I was doing the meetings. I think you and I actually met.
Fucking ridiculous, sir! It is fucking ridiculous. Yeah. I hate you, Hollywood.
Yeah, I saw 47 meters down at a buyer screen. I was like, "Get me that director."
Give
me that director.
It had
on
my
the phone.
Favorite jump scare of the year.
Before it became what it became. I was sort of taking some meetings, but it was not. I was not exactly, you know, like fighting offers off. And then I was just doing dinner with the producers of it, and they had got the script to Strangers, and they said, look, this just come, you know, we just got this from Relativity, who have offered it to us, and they, you know, they really liked the experience of working with me on 47 and like the movies, and they said, look, do you want to read it and see what you think? And I read it. I was a big fan of the first one, but the idea of doing a sequel, and I'm not the home invasion thing, there's has limited appeal. I like the first movie, but that's about as far as it goes. And I read it and I was like, do you know what? I mean, Ryan will know this. I read it and I went, you know what? I can make Christine here. I like that. It was very well written. And it was just like, yeah, do you know what? This actually could be pretty fun. And then 47 and Other Side of the Door were just painful movies to make, particularly 47. And this was just, you know, I got the script in October. We were out scouting different locations in sort of January, February, you know, going around to New Mexico, going around to Alabama and all that kind of stuff. And then we settled on Kentucky. We started in April, I think, just went through, shot it. People loved the film. I mean, when I presented my first cut, because the whole 80s vibe was not there, that was not the movie. And I sort of presented it, you know, with the burning cars and the Bonnie Tyler, you know, all that kind of, I'm just thinking, you haven't seen it, so I don't want to ruin anything for you. But
it's in the trailer.
I'm allowed to listen
to the trailer.
You can hear the interview, just not the trailer.
You know, the sort of full 80s vibe, and maybe the zoom lenses hadn't quite, you know, people hadn't quite noticed that in the dailies, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's suddenly on screen, you're like, wow, what is this, Amiga Man?
Uh-huh.
Sweet. Sold.
And I was like, yeah, someone's going to just tell me, just fucking dial it down. And there was this sort of moment, and they were like, okay, this is pretty good. And then they just went with it, and we tested it, and I thought the audience might kick back and maybe just say, look, I either don't get your style, or you're trying to be too cool for school, or whatever. I don't know, whatever. But actually, they just had a blast with it, and it was an easy process. I mean, you know, now.
Well, I get the vibe that you just embraced the more slasher element than the home invasion element of
Strangers. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I just had, you know, I had fun making the John Carpenter movie I've always wanted to make. Yeah. And I had fun doing. I think because I hadn't written the script, it gave me a freedom to tackle this cinematically in a way. I've wanted to get those zoom lenses out of the box for, you know, I've been doing this 20 years, and for 20 years I've been wanting to get those out of the box. And each time I'm like, it's just, they're embarrassing. People will think I'm, you know, like, what are you? And I was just like,
you're Nicholas Rowe.
Yeah. But that, you know, I mean, we had Don't Look Now. We were watching it over and over again, and we were, you know, performance and all that kind of.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck it, let's do it, this one. And I specifically hunted down Ryan Samuel, because I love Jim Mickle's stuff, and I loved Cold in July.
And that's a great movie.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's a really, really cool movie. So I was like, look, Ryan, you know, come on. I spoke to Dean Cundy about doing this. He really wanted to come on board.
Oh, yeah.
And he's been on the show before.
He was super nice. And, you know, I'd already gone away with Ryan down the path with Ryan when Dean sort of came on, you know, it's like, oh, Dean would be interested in this. Yeah. And we chatted, and he was, I mean, I would have just, we never would have got any fucking work done though. I'd be like, tell me more. So, and Ryan was just fantastic. And we just sort of went out, and I think it's not as I think my outlook is not as quite as nihilistic as Brian's in terms of the first movie. For me, when they cross the bridge into the trailer park, it's you've almost entered like a little world. It's like Cemetery Man. Mm-hmm. You know, you're entered into a little sort of snow globe of fantasy world. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a real movie, and it's horrible at times, but it, you know, there's a feel to it that's not, is slightly fantastical. Yeah.
Did you treat it, because I was asking Ryan before, because I didn't know if it was a remake or a sequel. I had no idea. I just knew it was coming.
I still don't.
Did you treat it like in your mind that the events of the first film existed in the chronology of these humans?
There's, you know, we played around with the script quite a bit. And we did, this was obviously a big discussion, so it went back and forward. And I shot some stuff where in the opening, I shot a scene which we didn't use, where there's a knock at the door and the leaflet from the first movie, the Christian Living leaflet, gets slid underneath. Yeah. So maybe I should include that on the DVD.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I thought that DVD, nobody watches DVDs anymore. on the VHS. Yeah. I had a lot of little things that, because I really do like the first movie. We had talked about the idea of even starting it the very next day. And do you know what the Avron, the guys releasing it, were like, you know what, we don't need that. And that's, it's only going to confuse it, because it fell in a weird time. 10 years, it wasn't a reboot. But equally, you couldn't. They didn't want to call it Strangers 2 because, you know, most of the people that are watching this weren't old enough by the time it came to cinema. Yeah. So it falls a little bit in both. So the way I look at it is it fits into the universe of Strangers. It's quite a timeless movie, I think.
It is, yeah.
There's a couple of bits of technology that actually get taken out very early, and after that it might as well be, you know, a 1970s movie. Yeah.
Now, well, because on that point, the original just came out from Scream Factory. We've been talking about it quite a bit. And what I found interesting, it gave me a new perspective to it, like hearing the new interviews with Brian and some of the cast members and them saying, I mean, I never thought of it, but they were saying this is the first movie is the first night they've ever done this. Mm-hmm. Like they might have, you know, played around and done stuff, but this is the first night they actually went through with murdering people. That's the way they interpret the final scene and all that. But to turn that into a question, was there any thought at all about bringing back the people that played the masked killers? Because obviously they thought about it a lot for the first movie, or at least they interpreted their stuff in there a lot. But at the same time, I know Damien, who plays the man in the mask. I'm happy that he's in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So was there any ever talk about bringing anybody back from the first one, or never came up?
it came up.
They're too old.
They
moved too slow.
Yeah, we had some interesting, I just saw a very interesting post from one of the strangers going, oh, I think they've made a terrible movie.
From one of the originals.
From the original?
Yeah. I see, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like,
they have characters? I mean, like, that was my question was, you know, you didn't bring them back. Like, is that mask, is there a characterization that adheres to that particular mask?
I decided to go with casting new people on it. It felt right age-wise and the whole sort of fitting in between the reboot and the sequel world. And they really took their, it was really fun. Like, Damien is crazy, man. Yeah. And he was great. He just really got into giving that each of them their specific role. So we didn't, I don't think I sort of saw too much of a connection with the first movie in terms of developing their character, but they, in this, they really did develop their characters within the movie, and they were having, it was very funny seeing, like, the first time we'd filmed them, and then by the end they were just playing, and they were just having, and they were genuinely just playing. You know, there's some horrible stuff that Damien does in that movie, and I'm like, wow, he's having a bit of fun. You know?
Yeah, they're much more aggressive and playful.
Yes,
it feels.
Yeah,
more playful. Yeah.
It was a fun because of the way we shot the horror on this. I didn't go for jump scares. I mean, there are jump scares in it, but that wasn't the way I wanted to scare people. So it's very much the camera captures the horror without trying not to do too many cuts and keep it all with just sort of zoom lenses and sort of one scene, you sort of just letting the camera hover there. So they just got to play around. And it's very much the dread of not being able to stop them and that there's no way to reason with them rather than having people jump out at you and that kind of scare. It's just to have someone sitting next to you that's just going to completely fuck you up and there's nothing you can do about it. So, but that was fun. Yeah, they were cool guys. They were cool guys. So, Damien's a cool guy.
I was going to say, did you have MPAA problems or any issues in terms of the violence and having to dial things back? Are we going to wind up seeing a director's cut that's much more violent?
There will be we'll have a look and see. No, in terms of the cut that you see there is...
It's what you want.
Is what I want, yeah. They were all very, very good to work with, and we were going for an R-rated, so we'll see on the DVD if there's, you know, I think people do love an unrated DVD, so yeah, there may be some stuff, but I felt we went pretty it's pretty brutal at times.
It's definitely a tone thing where it's just gnarly.
It's not a, like a full-on gore movie, so there wasn't too many problems.
You're going to be going on to doing 48 Meters Down. We should be talking about 47 Meters Down.
I have a lot of questions about 47 Meters Down.
Me too.
So first off, 90% of the movie takes place underwater. So were you in a tank? I assume parts of it were on the water.
Yeah, I mean, that movie was a bastard of a movie to do. And there's no two ways about it.
Well, that, and you just come off an international feature with, like, grandiose sets and crazy stuff like that. That was two, like, heavy, like, lifters back to back.
Yeah, so, yeah, the other side we had no money, but it was, like, because we were shooting in India, it was fantastic.
It felt huge.
Yeah, we built, I mean, we had tiny, it was smaller than either Strangers or 47, but we just built all this crazy sets and it was just amazing. I had a great time on that. And I had like a crew of like 300.
So you were actually building them in India.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, the exterior of the house on other side is where Rudyard Kipling was born.
Oh, cool.
And it was just this house that was just sort of rotting in the middle of Mumbai. And it was just like, fuck, this is brilliant. And it wasn't presented as, oh, this is the house where Rudyard Kipling. It was just like, oh, there's a statue there. Oh, yeah, this, what's his name? Oh, Rudyard Kipling was born here.
Oh,
and then
Jesus.
We were burning, like in the movie, we were burning copies of the Jungle Book on fire. And I was like, am I going to go to hell for this? I don't know.
Yes, you are.
But the whole inside of the house, I'd seen this incredible house in a different part of India that I was just like, holy shit, I love this, but it was impossible to film in. So we just made it. I mean, if you look at that movie and then look at the exterior and then look at the interior, it doesn't marry up. There's like a whole courtyard where it rains inside. But we built all that shit and it was great. And the temple, we built all that for no money. And then, I was like, do you know what? This was hard work. I want to do a movie where I'm in a tropical location with, you know, only two actors, you know, two girls in a beautiful place and sharks. And, you know, that's how I got into the movie. A shark movie. This is going to be great. And I ended up in an industrial park in Basildon outside London. And we, you know, we had to pour broccoli and milk into a water tank. And you know, everybody has to go to the loo.
Was broccoli and milk what they used for silt?
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's the strangest shit to decide to use. Like, who was it who was like, what works well for silt? Broccoli
yeah.
and milk.
Yeah,
Matthew
yeah.
Modine figured that out.
Yeah, Modine.
You go to Modine for those.
He's the fucking coolest dude in the world. Everybody needs a Modine.
Did you ask him Full Metal Jacket?
Oh, I mean,
Kubrick questions.
You cannot stop Modine talking about. But he tells them with such energy. I saw him the other night at we went to an Oscar party, and he was there, and he's you know when you meet the good ones, the ones you just want to hang out with, and he was like the crew were just like. Gather around him and listen to like all these stories. Yeah. His Rennie Harlan stories are fucking brilliant. and he has a brilliant story about how he got paid to not be in Flatliners, which is fantastic. You should get him on.
Oh my gosh, we'll reach out to
Ruby. Does stuff for us. She's been in a couple of her movies.
Do a
father daughter thing.
Yeah, he's good value. Good value. Yeah. But so doing the underwater thing. The problem I always have when I watch underwater movies, when I had to do the press junket, obviously every fucking question was, I'm allowed to swear on this.
Yes.
Not a problem.
Yes.
Sharks? No, well, it was the real sharks. And so what do you think of Jaws? And it's like, oh, for fuck's sake. You know, there's only so many Jaws questions you can answer. I never did this because of Jaws. I like Jaws, but I did it because I used to love Leviathan, and I used to love,
Becca's like, be still my heart. Yeah.
No, Aquatic Horror is totally my jam, and no one shares that predilection. It's the weirdest subgenre of like six movies, there's maybe five of us in the world who are really passionate about it.
You better cast Peter Weller in something.
Yeah, exactly.
He would look badass.
I have long said, anytime somebody's like, what's your dream project? Actually, I even said this at lunch today. I will remake Dead Rising at some point.
Yeah.
Deep Rising. It's going it's totally
and Deep Star 6, you know.
So many of them came out at the same time, right? Deep Star 6, Leviathan, and one more.
There was four of them. 1989 we got Deep Star 6, Leviathan, The Abyss, there was another one the Nick Nolte one. There was four
Deep?
Of them. No, The Deep was a couple years prior.
That was an early one.
I am confusing that one.
But then there was a bunch, right?
But yeah, there was like a whole bunch in one.
Year a few years later, it's just weird.
The
that was
Rift
so boring.
It's really good. So
that's I wanted to do that. The movies were always much better video covers than they were actually movies. And in fact, the first poster for 47 Meters Down was Leviathan with the girl going up.
Oh, that's
so
awesome!
It was great. But I always find that a lot of the times you watch the underwater movies and the water's so clear. I'm a diver myself, and I was like, this just I feel like I'm in a tank here. So. The guy that shot it's a guy called Mark Silk who's he's the underwater guy in England or one of them. And we were just talking about that and he was like, look, let's try. And I don't think anybody had ever done it before. He'd just done a movie called Black Sea, Jude Law submarine thing. Is it Black Sea? Something like that. He's a Jude Law play. It's by the guy that did Last King of Scotland. Nobody really watched it, but the underwater stuff was just so clean, and it was like, what do we do? And so we just had trucks of broccoli drive in, and
I'm still so intrigued by the broccoli because, you think, and I mean, granted, it was different silt, but silt is always very brown and beige and kind of flat. Broccoli seems like green and textured and colored.
Yeah, we would have all the sort of interns, the PAs, just mincing up the broccoli.
I was gonna say, was it chopped, boiled?
It was blended. I mean, the first dailies of the movie, and everybody's just trying to tell everybody else that this is all fine, this is all working, this is great. And you're watching Mandy Moore, and then it's sort of like a proper floret of broccoli is like I think, guys, we might need to
trim it down a bit.
But we had a special diver, Brian Broccoli, who would go around and sprinkle it. And the milk's a common thing to make the water a little cloudy.
Did they have to drain the tank afterwards? This seems like a whole thing.
Yeah, so I mean the issue was we were shooting in England and I just remember Mandy and Claire arriving and they thought we were going to be in Pinewood and we weren't. We were in between a recycling plant and this tank had it was an indoor tank but it was just like a big tent over it and it just looked It was horrendous.
How deep was it?
It's about 7 meters. I don't know what that's in American money, but it's sort of it was pretty deep. You know, the girls were doing their thing. Like, they were having to equalize, and, you know, at one point the cage went down pretty quick. I remember there were some stories I could probably tell you more offline. Yeah.
Did they have to get, like, diver certified for it?
I went diving with them here, actually, out in, what's the island?
Catalina.
Yeah. So we went out diving there. I had an amazing experience where we did our first dive, and it's pretty, actually, that was pretty full on for them, because it's quite intensive diving. It's very cold and it's quite tidal, quite sort of there's a lot of movement there,
your currents.
And at one point I was just sort of diving around, and then suddenly I look, I love diving, but I'm a terrible diver. I'm totally scaly. And suddenly Claire comes into my vision, and she's just looking at me like that, and I'm like, what the fuck? And then I look around, and Mandy and our diving instructor have gone. And so Claire's looking at me to, like, get us out of here, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm like fucking, I'm like, oh God, I'm going to panic, but wait, I've got to not panic in front of Claire. So I'm looking around. I have absolutely no idea where we are. I've got no sense of direction anyhow. So we're totally lost underwater. And what's happened is Mandy's bolted for the surface. You know, it's her first ever dive. She's gone up to the surface. He's then had to go on before. And I'm just like, I'm with Claire, like, hey, calm, calm. And I spoke to Claire afterwards, and she was like, she just thought I was just like, this happens to me all the time. eventually I saw another diver, and I was like, right, we're just going to hang around him, because he looks like he knows what he's doing.
Direction.
And then we got saved. But yeah, I mean, it was a story. To shoot the movie in England was it was just one of those things where the covering was a big tent. We don't really do aircon in England because it's always fucking cold. Mm-hmm. Yet we shot this in, like, the hottest summer. So you've got a tent, black tent. You've got the sun coming down. I've got broccoli rotting in there. I've got milk rotting in there. It's the same water over and over again. The tank's pretty old. Yeah, we're not talking cutting edge stuff. And then it's only, like, halfway through the shoot that I realize, like, nobody's going to the loo, because obviously they're all going to the loo in the tank, because you don't get out. Yeah. You can't get out. So it's urine, it's broccoli, it's milk, and it's the sun. And I've got this one kind of little aircon thing by me going,
what a stew.
Yeah, oh my God.
It was a
But in all defense, it's Mandy Morpie.
Yeah.
You know, could be worse, guys.
It's fresh.
So, I don't know. Yeah. I think that's creepy.
Yeah.
That's
right. I think when they realized what was going on there, that was going to be it. But they carried on going through that. I think they just sort of, they manned it out. But yeah,
would you go back to the same tank for the next one, or would you try
the next one's a bit bigger in terms of scale? So I we'll see. I'm not sure. You know, actually, the guys, it was fun, you know. I mean, it was crazy. We put the wrong sand in the tank or someone, you know, I don't quite know what happened, so we had to empty it. I mean, because nobody'd ever done the whole, nobody'd done a drama underwater, you know, proper talking. So even we had the Abyss guys on speed dial, the sound guys, and they were like, look, we didn't do this. We don't know how to do it. So we were having to work out how to, because it's impossible to, like, when you do, you just assume, like, okay, I'm going to speak to you like I can speak. But obviously, you're in a mask, and so how do you do it? And so they have these radio masks, but then the waves have got to go up, and then they've got to come back down, and nothing worked, and it was an absolute nightmare. And then, but the problem is when they would test it, they would go, no, it works fine, look. And you get the two testing people, they weren't actors, would come down and go, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then the other person would go, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'm like, okay, guys, you realize the script isn't just numbers. Yeah. You know? And they were like, you're just looking and seeing that the other person's finished 4. You're not actually hearing anything. And it was a fucking nightmare.
And meanwhile, all you're thinking about is, when am I just going to get on a boat with Modine? Shoot that one week of Modine stuff.
Now, here's like a super geeky filmmaker question that my husband actually pointed out to me while we were watching the movie that I've always been curious about. Eyelines. How did you do it? Because you're literally in a vat of nothingness, and the shark does not exist, obviously.
Yeah.
So how did you, like, in any way give them directions of which way to be emoting, looking, pointing,
that's a good question,
like
Becca.
That. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the whole filmmaking process underwater is insane. There's, you don't have any time. Like when you're on a normal set, it's like you set the shot up, mm-hmm. you rehearse it, and you practice it, you know, whatever. And then you're like, okay, and then the crew comes in, you do all the lighting, then you shoot it, and then you're like, oh yeah, yeah, and then you talk about it, and then you do whatever. You move. Here, there's no way you can block a scene out because there's zero gravity. So I had
literally nothing, and your creature doesn't exist, so there is nothing to block around.
Yeah, so it was just crazy, and you have to go in and you just have to make shit up, basically. That doesn't sound very... I'm sure Spielberg wouldn't come into a bother.
Make shit up.
We just made shit up. But no, so we had a shark. We had a guy with a shark's head. We bought something off eBay. One of these shark's heads that you put on, like, the wall. Yeah. And he would go behind and move. And that was useful for if it was hitting into a cage or if it was chomping on a leg or if there was a physicality to it. And otherwise, we would just have to fucking wing it. And we would, that really doesn't sound very talented, does it? I'm not getting any jobs off the back of it.
Sometimes filmmaking is just doing that.
It's just fucking doing it.
Yeah. You know, this was a movie. If there was ever a movie, like I started doing, you know, zero budget movies that nobody's ever seen kind of thing. And if there was ever a reason for doing those movies, it was this movie because I don't think any, you know, that it was just to have that experience of shooting a movie on $5,000 in 2 weeks that gave you the ability to tackle something like this. But yeah, a lot of it is you would just you'd have the scene in your mind. Nobody else would know what the scene is. My editor would, like, you would just have tons of dailies because I would never turn the camera off because there's no point in clapperboard everything. So I would, in my mind, I would know when he first got the stuff, he would be like, what the hell is all this? And I'd be like, no, from here to here, you don't use here, this, I'm thinking this bit here and this bit there. And he would start, because we worked together a lot, he would start to get, okay, I've just got to get it. This is shit, this is shit, this is shit. Oh, okay, I hear it from here and here. He knows what he's doing there. And it would just be, I would let the cameras move around and around and around. And I would just have to, in my mind, work the scene out. And nobody would, except really for me, would know what was going on. And I would just let the cameras go round and round, and then I'd be like, yes, okay, I'm seeing. Now, if they do that movement, that whole scene, and then the shark would come in, but it was, you know, there was a lot of... there's that great quote from the guys that did the Blair Witch. I remember someone interviewing them, and they went... they asked them, were you scared when you were making this movie? And one of them responded, yeah, I was scared we were making a piece of shit. And I was scared we were making a piece of shit. I really didn't know that this movie was going to work at all.
Did the actors feel that way? Because it sounds like it would be a pretty hard, you know,
they
not much of a net.
Yeah, it was a tough shoot. Yeah. And they put me through my paces, yeah.
Because the funny thing about it is that one of the things you think about with that movie is how strong the performances are.
Yeah.
That's the strength of the movie, their performances.
I think what the thing that that really worked on that movie was the script was conceptually so strong and so well structured that, and it was about those two. It was never about the sharks. In fact, the sharks became, you know, I made. In my mind, this is how deluded I was. The movie that was my sort of touchstone on that was the climbing movie. What's it called? Touching the Void.
Oh, that's such a scary movie.
It's insane, isn't it? I watched that movie and I was like, what the fuck?
Some of the best narration. It just haunts you.
That moment, you've got to be a certain kind of person to be like, I was down a ravine. I didn't know how to go up. Yeah. So what I thought is I'll go down. Who goes down? Yeah. Who does that? And so,
if you haven't seen that, if you're listening to this, you should watch it. It's one of the most terrifying films I've ever seen.
And it's just amazing.
What's it called again?
Touching the Void. Yeah. And it's about those two characters. I was just like, fuck. That's So I think that was the thing is that this movie was so strongly about those two characters that, and in fact, the first, we shot most of it. And we shot the movie and delivered the movie to the Weinsteins, had it initially. It really worked, but it was, it was chatting with Bob that we actually then, we went back for about a week and shot like a whole shitload of shark stuff. So actually it became a lot more sharky afterwards.
What was Bob's exact words after the first cut?
He was good, actually. But Bob was a very smart guy. You know, he is a smart guy, and he was constantly telling me, you can't sell circling sharks. That was his thing, and so I had that up in the edit room. I can't sell circling sharks. So he was like, I want these sharks to be more aggressive,
The big jump scare, which Becca was alluding to, which was probably the biggest jump I think I had that year, was that one of
no,
the
reshoots? No, that was a reshoot. Yeah, yeah.
Bob's right.
That was
right.
A good moment.
Yeah.
Now, were the sharks always, were they stalkery from the get-go? Because, like, in the plot, they literally, like, follow them down and they stick with them.
Yeah, I think the basics of it were there. We just, the stuff that I added back in, or added, I wrote, there was a scene where Mandy hides in a cave. Mm-hmm. That was an extra scene. We had a bit of fun with that. The whole end, we really amped up. That was already there, but we just didn't have, to be honest, didn't have the time and money. And I think everybody was a bit afraid that these sharks were just going to look fucking terrible. Mm. So it needed the movie to work for then... The Weinsteins came in and put more money in to do like the big jump at the end. I tend to find that I mean, we didn't do that on Strangers, but on Other Side of the Door, I did a good week afterwards because Have you guys ever interviewed Javier, the creature performer?
Oh,
Javier
Botet. Yeah, he's amazing.
He's a great, but we pretty much destroyed him on Other Side of the Door because he slipped over in a swimming pool and shat. He's got Malfans, I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh. He put his arm down. And he's triple jointed in every joint, which is why he's super cool. Yeah. But he shattered, literally, he shattered one whole half of his body.
Oh.
He shattered a femur.
Is that a thing?
I know. So I was we were just about to go on a location recce, and I could see, as a director, you get used to seeing conversations happening behind you and being able to judge, do I need to wander over? And I just saw this conversation happening in a corner, and I was like, I'm going to need to wander over here. So I wandered over, and they were like, what's going on here? And they're like, Javier's fallen over in the pool. And it's like, okay, let's go up and see what's going on there. And I remember walking up and just seeing this man, and already knowing, just as I was walking up, okay, he's fucked. And then you have to do two things. One, you have to be a human being. But the other, you have to go, right, okay, I've got to write that out. That's not going to work. Okay, that's got to go. And I have never seen a man in so, like when the Indian paramedics, again, I'm not, sorry, Javier, the Indian paramedics arrived. And the stretcher was literally two poles of wood with a piece of...
Oh, my gosh.
And Javier's like 7 foot. And they were trying to put him on. They were dressed like ice cream men. And they were trying to put it... You know, like literally, they didn't look real. I was like, guys, is this... And they were trying to put him on the stretcher. And he was screaming. And then they were like, they couldn't get him through the door. They couldn't get him into the elevator because it was too... Oh, my Lord.
Poor Javier, man.
Yeah, so they had to bolt him together. But then we got to go back, in a few months later. I don't think he wanted to, but we actually had a lot of fun.
Wow.
Talk about your upbringing. Where did you grow up? Where did the horror kind of seep into your upbringing?
I grew up in Cambridge, that well-known horror town. I sort of studied in a pretty sort of, it wasn't an amazing university. I don't think it was even a university. I got rejected. Like in England, you have at the time, you could apply to I think 7 or 8 universities, and I got rejected from all of them to do film, except for this one place that wasn't even a university, and they were like, oh, come along and see what happens, I didn't know I was going to be wanted to be a director. I just always love Stephen King, and I always love John Carpenter, and that's pretty much how
that's
I.
That's a good combo.
It is, and I just sort of run everything like that. Really, every day is just. And I just came out of university and put money on a credit card and made a movie called Sanitarium, which you can still get on Amazon. I wouldn't necessarily advise it, though. And it, you know, it sold, and that's kind of how it.
What did you learn from that one? Like doing that film?
I mean, we made that on, that was shot on Super 16, but we made it on $5,000. And I think the things that I learned that you can see when you watch that movie, I haven't got a fucking clue what I'm doing. Mm. Like, you genuinely can. But the thing that you can also see is I know how to assemble something and make. Mm. Like, that's a movie made on $5,000, but it's set in a psychiatric hospital. We've got wards. We've got, you know, I couldn't afford to make that movie now, you know. And it was, I learned that it was great fun. And I also learned you can know too much. Like, I shot that movie. When I shot that movie, my DP had to come up to me and go, so you know how to call a shot, don't you? And I was like, no, I have no idea. And he's like, okay, well, someone at some point is going to get camera rolling and then we're going to say, I had no idea about any of this. Mm. And then you go, you call action. You know, and I didn't know what a first AD was. So we didn't have a first AD. I didn't know what a producer was. We didn't have a producer. But my sound guy had a little red plastic Tandy mic that he plugged into a mini disc. And we lost everything because, you know, mini disc was the shittest format. And, you know, but we got through it and we made it. And I remember, like, at the beginning, I remember on the second, it was like 2 or 3 days in it, and we were shooting nights, and it never occurred to me that it gets light. And then when it gets light, you can't shoot nights anymore. And then suddenly we were 2 days in, and we were like a week behind. And everybody was like, oh, this is never going to happen. You don't know what you're doing. And the cast is like, this guy, he doesn't know what he's doing. We're going to call it. And I remember just walking around this abandoned psychiatric hospital with my camera guy. My DP was a secondhand car salesman who I'd met at university, and he had a Super 8 camera. So I said, "You're my DP." That was a sophisticated.
It's like Manos Hands of Fate. Yeah.
and I said, "Look, have I got to pull the plug on it?" And he was like, "Governor, he's probably English." He's like, "Governor, no, we'll get through this somehow." Yeah. And we did, and you know, and I learned you have to finish what you start. Yeah. Yeah. And that you could know, if I'd known how complicated it was, I never would have started. Yeah. But we just got through it. And then when I made the movie, we took it to Cannes. I showed it around to people, and people said, this is the worst piece of shit I've ever seen. Go away. Yeah. And then instead of going, no, it's my baby, I was like, okay, what have I learned? How do I do this? So I'd learned that you need a good trailer, you need a star, and you need some gore. So I called up Kodak and I said, look, I'm making a feature. I want to test your stock. Fuji have given me some stock and I want to test your stock. So they gave me a whole load of free stock. And then I called up Fuji and I said, look, Kodak have given me. So they gave me some more free stock. And we went out and we shot some reshoots. The only person, it probably doesn't mean anything to you, it still kind of means something in England, is, you know, I emailed like Sylvester Stallone. I emailed Christopher Lee. I emailed anybody I could find on like celebrityemails.com to be in my movie. And the only person that responded was a guy called Uri Geller, who bends spoons. Yeah, yeah. He was a massive,
he was huge.
Yeah, he was back in England. Yeah. And he wrote back and he said, yeah, I'll be in your movie. He's in the movie, and then we cut the movie. It was great fun, you know. I got to hang out with Uri Geller. I got to meet Michael Jackson because they were good friends at the time. It was a crazy ass time. Yeah.
Did Michael come out to your set?
No, they got married. Michael did. Uri got married again to his wife. Renewed their vows. Yeah, yeah. And Michael Jackson was the best man. So it's the weirdest. It was the weirdest. I'm there at like 21, 22.
Yeah.
The only person at the wedding not in a suit because I can't afford a suit. I'm trying to steal as much, you know, smoked salmon and champagne as I possibly fucking can. I've got Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics beside me telling me how shit my movie is, and he's just made a movie called Honest, which is even shitter. Yeah. I mean, he was a nice guy. And then I've got David Blaine, and then I've got Nigel Mansell, who was a Formula One car driver. It was the weirdest. And then Michael Jackson comes in late with a broken leg, and then they it's a Jewish wedding, so I've got and they dance around in the middle in a little arch thing to Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah.
And it was the most surreal fucking thing in the world. Wow. But we cut that movie together, and you know it's not a great movie. That's an understatement. But the script. It tried to do something. Yeah. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to write a script. I didn't even know how to format a script or how you should do anything. I didn't know any of that. And it just sold. It sold. It made money. You know, I made, for what I spent to the money I've seen, probably more money, certainly more money than 47 meters down in terms of profit. Yeah. You know,
jeez.
And it just, I was then able to say, you know what, I'm a film director. Right. I might be a very bad film director, but I'm a film director.
How did that parlay into a second feature?
I then went off and, because I co-directed that with a friend from university and the next one as well, which, and that was a real learning experience. And I think it's kind of affected my whole career up until, even up until Strangers, is the second movie I made was a movie called Alice. Hmm. And it's actually, in a sense, one of the most personal things I've made. It's about a clown hunter. So that sounds, so imagine vampires, but about hunting clowns. Yeah. And so it sort of went to my sense of humor. But it was, there was something really good about it in that it's this woman hunting the killer of her son. And she finds out that the killer is actually, the person that she thought killed her son is actually a clown hunter, and who killed her son is a clown. And a clown is an evil character that eats children but dresses up as a clown. It's a monster to fit into our world, into our society. And it was bonkers. You know, at one point she has a whole discussion with God. And God's going, look, you know, we need to talk about this. And she's like, well, look, can we catch up on Sundays? You know, I know how you like Sundays and stuff like that. It was a really bonkers movie. And it had Dominic Pinon from Amelie and Delicatessen. Yeah. I met him stealing sausages at a cat party in Cannes, and he was doing the same. And we just got on. We became good friends. We did like
great
four.
Face.
He's yeah, like he's, and yeah. He's a good one. He's a good guy. And we made the movie, and it... I shot it on Reversal stock. I think at the time it was the only movie to ever be shot on, full movie to be shot on Reversal and cross-processed. I used a lot of zoom lenses on that, and we had black and white stock. We used everything and anything, and people hated it, and nobody would sell it. Nobody would even touch it. And that really kind of scarred me and made me very nervous. So I then went into another movie after that called Dark Hunters, and the movie... That was my first movie that I directed on my own, and it was all back to front because I just watched Ghosts of Mars, and I loved all.
Wait a minute. I just want to go back and recall a Skype session that I had with him. I think it was probably 2 years ago after I saw 47 Meters Down, and I was like, get that man on the line. And we pull up, we're sitting in the Blumhouse conference room as we record this. We have a TV and we have a kind of like an eye in the sky camera for Skype sessions. And he pops up on Skype and he's got a Ghost of Mars poster, a quad, sitting behind him in his kitchen. And I go, hang on, before we even start, is that Ghost of Mars?
Wow. I was so proud.
I completely forgot about that.
I framed that poster.
Wow.
I framed it. Yeah, I had no money, and it was my first little bedsit place that I had of my own, and I framed this poster out, and I used to
bring Solution Jones needs to go there.
But I was all about this flashback within a flashback. And then because Alice had been such a disaster in terms of people not wanting it, then I rewrote, I did literally just before filming, sort of restructured Dark Hunters so it was linear. And then whilst I was in post on Dark Hunters, I recut Alice and retitled it Hellbreeder. I don't even know what a Hellbreeder is, but and then shot some inserts of like a detective stuff. And it sold really well then. Yeah. But I butchered my most personal movie too, because I knew like a movie needs to have an audience. It needs to be out there.
Right.
But I still have something in me that hurts a little bit. You can watch Alice on YouTube. Actually, I put it up there on YouTube.
Oh, really?
The full, and there's something about it that I think is beautiful. It doesn't, you know, I was learning, it's not a great movie. I'm not going to pretend it's, but it had something, it had a heart there, and that affected me in that I did a couple of movies afterwards, very, very low budget movies. One called Forest of the Damned, I think here it's called Demonic.
Yep.
And then something called When Evil Calls, which was like it was actually meant for cell phones, but then it was put together as a feature film. And they have their things, but they were done not with the same heart. They were done more to try and work out how to make a movie work with a commercial audience. Mm. And it to the point that after I did When Evil Calls, I didn't then work after 4 years. People didn't want anything to do with me for 4 years. Mm. So I really had to rethink about my whole career And then I did a movie called F here. I think it's called Expelled,
yeah.
which I love. Yeah. I'm not too many people have seen it. It's basically Assault Precinct 13.
It's cool. You should see it. I love Assault.
Yeah, it's the Breakfast Club meets Assault Precinct 13. And I just went and I said, you know what? I'm gonna stop trying to appeal to an audience, and I'm just gonna make a movie that I love. And so I think the whole Alice thing, really, the second movie really affected me. And I haven't dared get the zoom lenses out of the box until Strangers. And that's it's taken me this long to go, do you know what? I'm just going to do the shit that I love doing. So that's what I love about Strangers is it's not my script, but visually that's me on the screen.
Yeah,
that's our new inspiration quote, though, is we're going to get the zoom lenses out of the box. Yeah. You got the shark surfing, yeah. And I'm taking the lenses out of the box.
But it was literally like Indiana, you know, it's like this old dusty box. It's like, holy shit. I remember Ryan going, well, like we a couple of the shots we put together, and he was like, I don't think you can do this.
Yeah, but what I like about your story is you went from a guy who arrived on set and was like, what's an AD?
Yeah.
To commanding a set, just bringing out the zoom lenses, and taking on kind of three iconic villains in The Strangers.
Yeah.
Which is great. It's a great narrative. I want to go back to The Strangers really quick because I want to ask about your fixation on Jim Steinman. and the music that pops up
for our friend Brian Collins.
Yeah, Brian, this is for you.
Yeah.
What's the deal?
I'm a huge Jim Steinman fan. I'm
Collins is out there going, I want that man's number.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I always have been. Like, my brother used to play Bonnie Tyler in his room when I was a kid, and I used to read Lord of the Rings. And now whenever I read Lord of the Rings, I hear Bonnie Tyler, and it seemed to fit the world that he, I think he's one of the best songwriters ever. I mean, it's very operatic, but I think it's phenomenal music. And, we shot. I always knew that there was going to be an 80s track over the pool sequence, and so I had shot it with that in mind, with the lights and everything like that. And when we finished and put it together, I said to Martin, my editor, I said, look, drop over Total Eclipse of the Heart. And we didn't even try a different play. We just plonked it over, and it just worked. And we never tried another track. We never did anything else. It just left. And then it was like I realized when we were cutting the movie that the car was playing such a big part, you know, the whole Christine thing. And I was like, okay, well, let's have the car always playing music out of it. And then it was like, I was really getting into the Air Supply song, Making Love Out of Nothing at All. And I was like, do you know what? Because the whole ending, I there's a certain point in horror I get at. I'm like, okay, I'm bored of the chase now. And I like things to go a little bit crazier. And the whole end there, I was like, it felt beautiful rather than like a terrifying bit, you know, with the flame car. And I was like, Martin, do you just want to, I'm just going to pass this track to you and just put this over the top. Because we tried all the kind of horror, sort of make it really scary. Yeah. And we put Making Love Out of Nothing at All over that. And I was just like, this is giving me tingles. I've made a meatloaf video. I'm there, and I just thought, no one's ever going to let me get away with this, and this is going to come straight back to me. And it went to Avron, and they watched it. I was never at that screening, but no one ever said anything. I think they really liked it. I think, and then we had some trouble because Jim knows his song's worth.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a music budget on this movie because it never was supposed to have all this. So poor James, you know, James, don't you, the producer, poor James is suddenly presented with, like, you know, it's got like some big tracks
in. It's got big tracks.
And he's like, okay, what am I supposed to fucking do? Yeah. But I think.
However, so how did you get around all of that?
Do you know what? It was a mixture of. Actually, people were really quite reasonable and really wanted to be a part of the thing. And also, I had to go. to Avron and go, guys, you like this?
Pitch in a little bit.
Yeah. And they were really, because they loved it. You know, I think they really. It's amazing when a movie works. I'm saying this in my mind. The movie worked, and it had so much fun to it that they just wanted. They were like, do you know what? Let's. You know, we weren't asking crazy money, so they really got behind it. And the great thing, what I love about them, is how they've embraced then what I did with the music, with the whole marketing. I mean, the marketing of this movie has been, it's just everywhere. Crazy. But it's bonkers. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's just...
It's your Facebook profile pic, but it's... I think it's Dollface doing...
Oh, Rosie Rocket.
We can gut him.
Yeah.
I mean, we can gut him.
Yeah. It's just weird. Yeah.
I got an email earlier this morning asking me if I'd like to review the Strangers Pray at Night soundtrack.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, they're really pushing the soundtrack, too.
Oh, great, yeah. I mean, that really reinvigorated my whole love of what I do, is going home every night and I'd be like, okay, what we have in England, I think you have here, like, Now tapes, like before Spotify, you would have like a collection of the best singles. I think they're on like Now.
Now that's the gym track. Yeah. Now that's the 80s.
Yeah. So basically, what Strangers is Now 9. That was the Now that was the Now tape that I had when I was young, and I was like, okay, let's try this, let's try that, and then some of it was new. Like the Kim Wilde, there's like a Kim Wilde track called Cambodia. Mm. And we were having real trouble with the scene because it was pretty full on scene. And like certain bands were like, no, I don't want to be, this is too full on for us. And then I was like, what are we going to do? And we'd used Kim Wilde for the beginning of the movie. And I was looking up some stuff. And then I just saw that title and it was like Kim Wilde Cambodia. And I'm like, has Kim Wilde sung a song about Nam? It's a pop song about Nam, and I was like, fuck, this is going in, and I just loved it. It's one of my favorite tracks. So I think everybody was a bit bemused when I was like, guys, I want this. They're like, really, you know, you don't want something. But yeah, but the Jim Steinman thing is, and he was great. Do you know what, at one point I actually suggested that we scored the whole soundtrack with his music. Mm. And we actually tried it. We tried like Rock and Roll Dreams Come True, Good Girls Go to Heaven, Bad Boys Go Everywhere, whatever. And I tried loads of different Jim Steinman tracks and More Bonnie, More, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that was a very long answer of saying I'm a big
massive
fan. No,
because it gives insight into the music process people. I don't think people realize that, you know, in the experience in the edit, directors plunk in the songs that they want.
Yeah.
And then as producers, we sit there and go, oh, this song really works, but oh my god, we only have $25,000 for the music budget, and then we got to figure out how to make it work.
Yeah, you know? It's a tricky one. What you have to do. Obviously, you can't, like, if I deliver a cut and it's got, you know, Sympathy with the Devil or Gimme Shelter on, you know, and people are just going to go, no, that's. I think there's like a set, you know, you pay $1 million for that, so you can't do that. The other thing is what you got to try and do is just get what you want into a test screening.
Yeah.
Because then once people are married to it,
exactly.
Then
it's
always like directing is just poker, isn't it? Yeah. It's just, you know, you just got to try and persuade people. But I have to say, Avron have been amazing with that. You know, it brought the movie to life and everybody was like, fuck it, let's just go with this. You know? But I've never done it. I've never put a track in. I actually wrote one of the songs at the end of the movie.
I did see in the credits there was some thing.
I used to be in a band when I was 16 and my best friend got married just recently, and so for his wedding present, I got together the band, and we recorded a song that we wrote when we were 16, and then I've snuck it into a car radio thing.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's it.
Well, very cool. Well, hopefully everybody gets out to the theater this weekend to see it. Dude, it was great having you on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for chatting. Thank you for inviting me. Okay, thank you.
Looking forward to seeing what you do with 48 Meters.
Yeah. The Descent Underwater is my pitch on
Salt.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Cheers.